I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Would security at American airports have detected the kind of non-metallic underwear bomb that Saudi double agent handed over to the CIA in what's being called an extraordinary intelligence coup? The FBI is now analyzing the bomb at its lab in Quantico, Virginia, after the Saudi Arabian operative who'd infiltrated al-Qaeda in Yemen left Yemen with the bomb on what al-Qaeda thought was to be a suicide mission to bring down a U.S.-bound airliner. Scott Shane of the New York Times has been following all of this. Scott, it's an incredible story. The bomb maker is believed to be Ibrahim Hassan al-Asiri, also a Saudi-born man in his early 30s, and the bomb is supposed to represent an evolution in technology. What were the other bombs he's thought to have designed, and why was this one different?
Well, he's been sought by American counterterrorism forces, obviously, for a long time, certainly since the Christmas bombing attempt that everyone will remember in 2009, when the so-called underwear bomber got on a flight bound to Detroit, and that one failed only because the chemicals fizzled, essentially, and other passengers intervened. You know, he made it all the way through the system. Then in 2010, there were the two bombs put inside printer cartridges and sent aboard cargo planes. Those bombs made it aboard the planes, but they were detected before they reached the United States. And this would seem to be the third try to get a bomb aboard a U.S.-bound airliner. This same guy, al-Asiri, who's considered to be a very skilled bomb maker, adjusted his design, and the FBI folks are being somewhat closed-mouthed, but they say that it does appear to be somewhat more sophisticated, somewhat more difficult to detect, even than that underwear bomb in 2009.
Well, what we are hearing is that it's non-metallic, so metal detectors would presumably not work. But body scanners would. I mean, the Obama administration officials there are saying new body scanners at U.S. airports would have detected this bomb?
Well, you know, they're studying that right now, and I think that they have sort of made a preliminary assessment that probably they would have detected this. That may not be terribly reassuring. I suspect that we'll hear for a while at least a lot fewer complaints from air travelers about having to go through those newfangled machines that show an outline of the passenger's body.
Well, maybe, but the other question that's raised, though, is those body scanners are only at about 180 of the 450 airports in this country, and they're at not too many of the departing airports. In other words, what does it matter if we have the scanners here if these people are coming from other countries on inbound planes from airports that don't have the scanners?
Well, I think that's what obviously keeps security officials up at night. I guess the one thing you could say is that there are different ways to stop a terrorist attack. And stopping a suicide bomber at an airport as he tries to board a plane is not the ideal way to do it. And that's why they have tried to go on the offensive in cases like this. And by infiltrating al-Qaeda, they've pushed the bomb way back away from the United States, away from airplanes, and they basically got nowhere with this plot, because if there are enough suicide bombers with sophisticated explosives trying to board planes, one of these days someone's going to make it through.
Yeah, chilling thought. But how are officials reacting to that we know? In a minute, we're going to be speaking to an FBI official about cyber attacks, and his point is no more playing defense. Let's go on the offense. You know, as you've been saying, try to get to the people who are sending them. Try not to just deflect the attacks that come in. So do we know how officials here in the U.S. are trying to think ahead of these attackers? You know, what might a next evolution in bomb making be?
Well, I think they're trying to get ahead of the bomb maker by, you know, going after the group itself, keeping them on the run and trying to prevent them from being able to build a bomb, presumably based on information supplied by the agent who infiltrated the al-Qaeda branch in Yemen. There was a drone strike in Yemen on Sunday that killed the so-called external operations chief of that al-Qaeda branch, the guy who planned plots against the United States and other countries,
including the bombing of the USS Cole.
Yes. You know, it's incredibly disruptive for this tight-knit terrorist group, first of all, to have some of their members killed and have to worry about drone attacks. But secondly, now that they've discovered that this guy who was in their midst and who they trusted as an operative, as a martyr, turned out to be an agent and an enemy, you know, they must all be looking at one another, kind of wondering, can I trust this guy? Is this guy another double agent?
Scott Shane of the New York Times on the foiled al-Qaeda plot to use a new underwear bomb. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And today, FBI Director Robert Mueller cited the mission in Yemen as he urged Congress to reauthorize certain forms of surveillance of foreigners to prevent attacks. Our next guest says Congress needs to act on cyber attacks. Congress is debating proposals to improve the security of U.S. computer systems. The House just passed a measure to increase information sharing between the government and technology companies. But some businesses are worried about consumer privacy. And the president has threatened a veto. He's worried about classified information going the other way, from the government to private companies. The Senate's also debating two bills. Arizona Republican John McCain's relies on voluntary action by companies, in other words, no regulations. Another from Senators Joe Lieberman and Susan Collins, with administration support, would establish federal cybersecurity standards that critical companies like utilities would have to meet. Whatever Congress does, our next guest says it's overdue. According to a new report, the U.S. is woefully unprepared, and Sean Henry says there is already a cyber war going on. He was the top cybersecurity official at the FBI. He retired recently to become president of the security firm CrowdStrike Services. Sean, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Glad to be here.
You said recently the cyber threat is an existential threat. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that too oftentimes people think about the theft of credit cards and the theft of personally identifiable information or some money was taken out of my bank account, which certainly are important things that we need to address. But I think that the cyber threat is much, much larger than that, much more substantial, and that the attack on critical infrastructure can actually have physical implications, which could cripple our country in certain respects and could actually lead to death. You think about our water treatment facilities, pumping water, pumping fuel out of the ground, the transportation sector, if the trains were to stop running or if airlines couldn't take off the ground. These are the types of things that run and require computers. The reality of it is those computers, when they're touching the network, are vulnerable. We've said for a long time that a determined adversary with enough time and enough money can get into any computer system. And quite frankly, the offense outpaces the defense, and that is a threat to all of us.
You mentioned stealing personal information. There's also hacking, cyber attacks, just to demonstrate that it can be done. But what else has already been done?
There are many, many companies involved with developing our next-generation weapons systems, clear defense contractors that do very sensitive work for the government that have been breached by foreign intelligence services. There are companies in many sectors like the retail sector, the energy sector, the financial services sector that have been breached by foreign intelligence services as well as organized crime groups. And the value of the data that's been taken, it's research and development, it's intellectual property, it is information that has taken billions of dollars to create, millions of man hours to manufacture, and that information has been stolen and is being used by adversaries to undermine our economy, to embolden or empower the host government's companies, and it has an impact on our economic and national security.
In fact, the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit, a research group, has assessed that the annual loss of intellectual property and investment opportunities across industries is $6 to $20 billion. One company lost $1 billion, 10 years worth of research in one weekend. I think you, when you were at the FBI, were aware of that. Others have been forced to close.
We had a company that actually, it was a small company, but they were literally in business on a Friday. They had an attack over the weekend, and on Monday they were out of business because they lost all their operating capital. The reality of it is, once an adversary has an access on the network that is as pervasive as we've seen, they also have the ability to change the data, moving decimal points a couple of places to the left or the right, or changing the coordinates on a weapon system. It's not just about the confidentiality of our data, but it's also about what the adversaries can do to the data once they're physically on that network.
Well, then we have this report from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. It was the National Preparedness Report, and it really is to assess how states would respond to crisis after Hurricane Katrina and 9/11. So we're taking in a big picture view of the emergency medical reaction, utilities, far broader. For instance, all but three states found they had sufficient staffing capacity to have medical workers who could work 12-hour days for 6 to 8 weeks, that kind of response. But then, when it got down to cybersecurity, that seemed to be the most troubling response. It was the single core capability where states had made the least amount of overall progress. Only 42% of state and local officials said that theirs was adequate. 45% said they didn't have a formal program to prevent and respond to. attacks. You probably already knew this.
Yeah, you know, Robin, it's interesting because when you use Hurricane Katrina, that's an example I've used many times in the past, the cascading impact of an attack. So in Hurricane Katrina, after the hurricane and the flooding, the power was out. And the types of things that you saw subsequent to that after just 3 or 4 or 5 days were people starting to die. And when I talk about an existential threat, I think Katrina is an example. That was a natural disaster. But if you think about somebody actually turning the electric off within a city, that cascading impact where people can't go to work and work X number of shifts, where people can't get the necessary life-sustaining care that they need, all because the electricity is out or all because there's not potable water.
Okay, well, let's talk about what you advise, because the FBI has made great strides in finding some of these organized groups and arresting them. But you say that's not even the issue anymore. It's too late to play defense. We need to play offense. What do you mean?
I'm very proud of my service at the FBI, and I've worked with so many incredibly capable people there, and I think that we have had a lot of success. But I also have said that the private sector needs to take a larger role in this defense, because the government currently doesn't have the authority to protect the .com space. So the government protects .mil and the government protects .gov, the military and the government networks, but the commercial space is not being protected right now by any particular agency.
Can I hold you up for 1 second? Do you think the government is really protecting .gov and .mil? I mean, they have been penetrated.
They have the authority to do it. I know that there are a lot of people that are working very hard to do that, people that I've worked with very closely for a long time. But there's nobody that has the authority to protect the .com space. And
right.
I recognize that there are concerns people have about privacy and about civil liberties and the aggregation of data, which you referred to. And I understand that. I mean, I protected civil liberties and civil rights for 24 years during my service in the FBI. But I believe that if that's not going to happen and the government is not going to be in that space, then the private sector needs to innovate and the private sector needs to do more. For too many years, we have been playing defense and we've been building bigger walls and we've been putting new firewalls in place and we've been looking at malware and we've tried to parry the blows. We're trying to defend against the attack. And you cannot stand there and continue to take punches over and over and over again. There's more that network operators can do internally to protect their networks, being proactive, where they can start to identify who the adversary is. And by doing that, when you start to recognize their tactics, their techniques, their procedures, you can start to build a profile of who they are. And when you do that, you can become predictive about where they're going and what they're going to do once they're resident on your network, and then you can start to become preventative.
We're talking about cybersecurity, the topic of hot debate in Washington. Here's Army General Keith Alexander at a Senate hearing in March explaining Defense Department thinking on the matter.
When we see what our folks are capable of doing, we need to look back and say, there are other smart people out there that can do things to this country. We need to look at that and say, how are we going to defend?
You might have heard NPR's Tom Gelton's terrific reports on this over the past couple of days. He also spoke with Mike McConnell, former U.S. Director of National Intelligence, who underlined the urgency, telling Tom that a key concern is a lot of countries are creating tools to fight cyber battles, but there are so many out there, they could actually be turned into weapons.
The worry is what happens when some of those tools, and there are thousands of them, get released inadvertently, or it's somebody steals it to sell to a terrorist group, somebody who has a different view of the world order and wants to change things.
And the biggest debate is over how do the government and the private sector intersect? Tom talked about how the government has been holding special one-day classified security briefings 2 or 3 times a year, part of a private-public partnership called Enduring Security Framework, in which CEOs of major companies like Hewlett-Packard are taken behind closed doors to hear what other nations are developing and what the U.S. has in its own arsenal. As one government official told Tom Gelton, we're scaring the bejesus out of them. And Richard Belchis, chief security officer for a security company called Mandiant, said the experience was life-changing for one CEO.
You got a one-day secret clearance. General Alexander sat him down, told him what was going on. This particular CEO, in my opinion, should have known, but did not. And now it's colored everything about the way he thinks about this problem.
And we've been talking about cybersecurity with Sean Henry. He was the head of cybersecurity for the FBI. He recently retired to become president of CrowdStrike Services, a security firm. He'd been explaining to us the threat to our data is an existential threat, a cyber version of Hurricane Katrina. Sean, you're looking particularly at what companies should be doing because even in the U.S., many critical infrastructure companies, like power companies, are private. So where do you think companies should start?
Companies need to assume that there is an adversary on their network. You cannot wait anymore for your intrusion detection system or your firewall to provide you with an indication that there's been a breach, because the significance and the capabilities of the adversaries that we've seen allow them to jump right over the wall. When I was in the Bureau, there were dozens and dozens and dozens of times where we showed up, told the CEO or some senior level official that the network was breached. We found that company's data elsewhere on the internet. And in many cases, these companies did not know that they'd been breached. And in many cases, they'd been breached for months. In the physical world, it would be equivalent to you coming home from work, you come into your house, and you get a knock on the door from a police officer, says, we just found your television and $500 cash in the street or around the corner in somebody else's house. And you didn't even know that somebody had broken into your home. You had no idea that these materials were even missing.
You said something like, if the government isn't going to do something about this, business has to. Weigh in on this. I know you're a former government employee, so you may hesitate in part, but you know, the debate seems to be over privacy. But on the one hand, we have President Obama's administration pushing Congress. We hear there's a drumbeat from the Obama administration about the need for Congress to pass legislation giving the Department of Homeland Security some authorities to regulate this. On the other hand, the U.S. Chambers of Commerce, big lobbying group, which was itself breached, lost information on its 3 million members, but it's fighting any kind of regulation. It wants industry to be self-regulating. Where do you come down on this?
It's an incredibly complex situation because of privacy issues, because of policy issues, because of legal issues. So when I said earlier, you know, the government has the authority to work in the .mil space and the .gov space, the government owns those networks, but the vast majority of the networks are in private sector hands, and it's their responsibility to step up, and it's their responsibility to innovate and protect their networks. The government is working hard. I've been up on the Hill, and I've spoken to many legislators about some of these challenges that we face and about some of the things that I believe that we can do better as a government to help protect the private sector. But these are complex issues that may take years to navigate, and in the interim, U.S. corporations are being hit every single day, and we can't just wait for a solution to come up.
How do you feel about the government requiring businesses, maybe not to share their information with intelligence agencies, but requiring that businesses prove that they're undertaking some of the proactive moves that you talk about?
These are the types of discussions that we need to continue to have. Information sharing is critical. When I was in the FBI, the success we had in identifying adversaries and actually going out and putting our hands on them to take them off the playing field to actually mitigate the threat, in those cases, the vast majority of those investigations, it was a company coming forward and saying that they had some information that was of value that allowed us to kind of get on the trail immediately. I recognize that the private sector and the public has concerns about how we do that. But I think the private sector needs to understand what the threat is and understand that there needs to be actions. We go every single day, get on an airplane, and it takes 15 or 20 minutes. We've got to go through security. We've got to take our jacket off. We've got to take our shoes off. We've got to walk through the magnetometer. There's not a person in the United States that wants to do that, but everybody recognizes that there's a serious threat that we face. There are people who have threatened our society. They want to kill people. They want to blow up planes. I think on the network side, it's very similar.
Well, meanwhile, you advise companies to keep their most valuable data off their networks. Is that possible?
What I've suggested or recommended to companies is think about what you actually put on the network. Because we have a network doesn't mean we have to put everything on there. There's data that can be compartmented. There's data that can be put on the network only for the very purpose of sharing it and then taken off the network. There are certain operating procedures that would make them safer and would help to better protect their valuable information.
That's Sean Henry, again, the top FBI cybersecurity official until recently. He retired and became president of CrowdStrike Services, a private company aiming to get companies to assess and respond to potential cyber attacks. Sean, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin. I appreciate your time.
Eurovision, the annual song competition held by the European Broadcasting Union, gets underway this coming weekend. 600 million people around the world are expected to watch the contest, which this year takes place in the oil-rich country of Azerbaijan. This means human rights groups will also be watching and calling on the organizers to ensure that the government stops imprisoning opposition members, beating journalists, and destroying homes in the name of development. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch say Azerbaijan now has one of the worst records in Europe when it comes to freedom of speech. Even musicians have been attacked for speaking out against the president. The BBC's Daniel Sanford reports from the Azeri capital of Baku.
A woman is dragged screaming from her home in the heart of historical Baku. It is to be destroyed by developers linked to the ruling elite, and she is unhappy at the compensation on offer. The Azerbaijani capital is in the middle of a construction boom, fueled by a massive increase in oil and gas exports. This is a country on the up, but in the process, some people's dream of a beacon of democracy on the Caspian Sea is being crushed. On the seafront, they're putting the finishing touches to a new concert hall. President Ilham Aliyev and those around him have a different dream, to put Azerbaijan on the map, and they're using Eurovision to achieve it. The inside of Baku's brand new Crystal Hall is buzzing with activity. There are lighting men from Germany and riggers from Russia. Staging this year's Eurovision Song Contest has brought much wanted attention to the ambitious young country of Azerbaijan. But it has also brought an unwelcome spotlight onto the country's poor human rights record.
Jamal Ali is my name and surname. I used to be a rapper. Now I don't know what style is it. Whatever is it, it's just some music.
Jamal Ali recently spent 10 days in prison after insulting the president while performing on stage at an opposition protest.
Police told each other that, just can get this guy off the stage right after the song. I was taken out from the cell twice and was beaten. I had a bag on my head and handcuffed from the back, and I was sitting on the chair with my legs on another chair, and they were beating me in my heels with stick, with that button, for 3 hours for the first time and 2 hours for the second time.
With a bag over your head?
Yeah. Oh.
In hospital, I found Idrak Abbasov, struggling to breathe with two broken ribs, a badly bruised face and severe concussion. He's a journalist who'd been beaten 3 days earlier by guards from the state oil company for filming some homes being demolished. There are signs that under the Eurovision spotlight, the government has relaxed its grip slightly. This was one of three opposition demonstrations in the last month. Before that, all protests had been banned for 5 years. A senior official in the presidential administration, Ali Hasanov, told me that human rights groups are being too harsh on Azerbaijan. He claimed the government had widespread popular support.
Even among those whose homes have been demolished, and among journalists, 99% are satisfied and only 1% are unhappy. In which country in the world are all the people satisfied?
All around Baku, among the houses on the edge of town, the nodding donkeys of oil wells pump the country's wealth out of the ground. It is this money which helps keep President Ilham Aliyev in power. And out in the Caspian Sea, there are huge reserves of oil and natural gas, which will help him to stay there for many more years, long after the human rights spotlight that has come with Eurovision moves on.
The BBC's Daniel Sanford in Baku, Azerbaijan. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg is on a cross-country roadshow this week, taking questions about what's forecast to be the biggest IPO in internet history, a company valued at $100 billion or more. Billion, yeah, with a B. About two-thirds of America is on Facebook. There are 845 million active users around the world. But our next guest says, hold on, when it comes to that IPO, Facebook and Google, for that matter, might completely disappear in the next 5 years. Not bankrupt gone, but MySpace gone. Eric Jackson is a contributor to Forbes. He's also founder and managing member of the investment firm Ironfire Capital. He has himself invested in Apple and Yahoo. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, it seems impossible. Facebook and Google, they're not pets.com. So why do you say they might be gone in 5 years?
Well, it's always a humbling experience to try to kind of put yourself back in time 5 years or 10 years. It's pretty amazing how far off the conventional wisdom in the moment usually is. I remember more than 10 years ago now picking up a newspaper and reading about how AOL was going to buy Time Warner, mm-hmm. and this was going to revolutionize our world. And
oops.
Obviously, that vision didn't work out.
Yeah, it did not work out at all. And you also mentioned MySpace. They built a network of people. Originally, they all loved music, but MySpace isn't, you know, where's MySpace? And you talk about generations of, you know, web companies. Go through that.
Well, about 15 years ago, I went to study for a PhD in management, and I was studying the effects of leadership on companies' strategy and performance. And I had this bias that people matter, and if you have the right new kind of strategy, you can overcome any challenge that you face in your competitive environment. And at the time, there was a school of thought, it was mostly sociologists who were called themselves organizational ecologists, who said that whether a company succeeded or not depended on when they were born and what industry they were in. And I kind of scoffed at it at the time, but certainly as I watch what's going on in the internet world, those ideas seem to be more and more relevant. You know, at the time, these academics were looking at things like the steel industry and other industries that really didn't change all that much. And yet in the web world, I think we've lived through three generations already in the past 15 years.
Go through some of those. Web 1.0, a company's founded from 1994 to 2001. Which would those be?
These are kind of, you know, the internet pioneers, Yahoo, the original search engines before Google, like Excite and Alta Vista, and they were all about aggregating data. They were the owner of the information. And then around 2002, 2003 or so, we had this Web 2.0, or, you know, now we call them social companies. Facebook's obviously the biggest one in that group. And these companies became interested in tapping into the users' social connections. And then very recently, I think starting in about 2 years ago, we had a new generation, I think, of companies begin in the internet world, which I say are mobile-focused. And these companies only are focused on delivering a service to you on your mobile device. They don't really even think about even having a website anymore.
Okay, so let's take your theory. Oh, actually, it's the theory of these organizational ecologists.
Right.
You've got Google, one of the first generation Web 1.0 companies. And Google's still around. But as we're seeing, now you have the mobile platforms. Google's a lot harder to do on your small handheld smartphone. And instead, you might be talking to Siri.
What's interesting is that these older generations, they can see that the competitive environment is changing, and yet they seem really incapable or ineffective in adjusting to that new environment. Google is great in search, but really has been not great in a social product, you know, including their new Google Plus product.
So Google Plus, that's Google's attempt to do some of the social networking?
Yes. And, you know, and there are examples. I think Apple is probably the best example of a company that does continue to innovate and to come up with completely new products that nobody even knew that they wanted. So it is certainly possible, but I think the probabilities are against somebody like a Google and a Facebook.
Well, in fact, you quote Hamish McKenzie saying that he suspects that Facebook will try to break up its various features into separate apps, one for messaging, one for maybe a news feed, one for pictures. But then that fragments what they were, and they're not Facebook.
Right.
And we're talking about whether or not Google or Facebook will adapt to mobile. You point out Forget mobile. It's almost too late for that. The next thing is coming soon.
It's crazy as it seems. You know, the pace of change is only increasing. And if you go back and you look at how long Web 1.0 lasted and how long the kind of the social era lasted, you know, it's getting shorter and shorter. So it's going to be even more difficult to really continue to be on top of the industry and on top of their game.
You quote Tim Cook on an earnings call for Apple. He says, it took them 2 years to ship out 67 million iPads after the iPad was invented. And to put that in context, it took 24 years to sell that many Macs, over 3 years to sell that many iPhones. So, bam, you know, pretty soon it's going to take one day to sell 67 million of the next new thing.
And the other thing that that speaks to is just that there's always a new thing. And whenever the new thing comes now, we are just a lot more quick to jump all over it. We hear about it faster through Twitter or Facebook, and we want to immediately try it. And if we like it, we're just going to be that much faster to turn our backs on what we formerly had been using. So, you know, you log into Google every day, but, you know, whether you're going to come back tomorrow just depends whether Google's the best option to get the information that you want or whether there's something else that's better. There's nothing else locking you into going back to Google.
Right. Well, you're not the only one with concerns. Jeff Cox of CNBC writes about other companies that have deflated after IPOs, Zynga, Groupon, Pandora. And I'm just wondering, yes, you know, there are millions of users, but how many ads can you slap on Facebook? How much can you charge, you know, if those users drop off to achieve this 100 billion promise? You know, that's how much the IPO is expected to be.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's going to be more than that. It wouldn't surprise me if that in the first few days after it goes up to 150 billion, because I think people are just so gaga for the new hot tech story. And Facebook certainly is right now. But I think you put your finger on, there are one of two real concerns about this company. One, are you really going to be able to sell the number of ads as much as Facebook is insisting that they will be? And two, what are they going to do in the mobile world? Because right now they're losing money every time a user accesses Facebook via a mobile device. They make all their money from sort of a desktop PC way of logging into Facebook. So there are big uncertainties hanging over this company.
Well, you've just in a very small way offset the hype, you know, because there's still a heck of a lot of hype. Eric Jackson, a contributor to Forbes magazine, also founder and managing member of the investment firm Ironfire Capital. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to say two words, and if you are a theater lover, you will fall into a deep swoon. They are Bernadette Peters. Okay, we'll wait. Bernadette Peters has been nominated for 7 Tony Awards. She's won 2. She'll be receiving a special Tony Award for her work with animals next month. Then there were her films. Steve Martin wrote her part in The Jerk for her, and there was Mel Brooks' silent movie. And on NBC's relatively new TV show Smash, the behind-the-scenes making of a Broadway musical, who else would they want but Bernadette Peters to play the Tony Award-winning actress who the cast begs to perform a signature tune from Gypsy? Bernadette Peters is going to open the Boston Pops season tonight. Lucky people who have a ticket. She joins us from a kind of an empty office. Bernadette, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I was going to ask you, you know, sophisticated questions about approaching Symphony Hall's acoustics or interacting with conductor Keith Lockhart. But who am I kidding? We all decided what we really want to know is, what is it like to be Bernadette Peters?
Well, Bernadette Peters is thrilled to be singing with the Pops because it's one of the best orchestras in the country, and I love Keith Lockhart. So what can I tell you? You're happy if you're me.
I mean, does it at this point feel effortless for you to embody a song?
Oh, you know, I love singing, and when you do concerts, you get to choose what you want to sing, and so I pick things that I have a strong connection with and that I love to revisit. And wonderful things like No One Is Alone and Children Will Listen. And it's just great for an audience to hear also.
Care for the things you do, children will see and learn.
Can you give us a sense of some of the things you might be playing? We've heard that you might sing When You Wish Upon a Star.
Yep, that could be. And I believe I'm going to be doing some songs from Follies, the show I was just in. But, you know, I never like to tip my hat ahead of time of what I'm going to be doing. I like sort of like the audience to go on this, to be surprised and, like, enjoy the evening and enjoy the journey.
Well, just, I mean, you may not sing it, but When You Wish Upon a Star, in so many ways it's just seared on many memories. But what is it about that song that...
A star is something anybody can wish on. You don't have to be rich, you don't have to be pretty, you don't have to be anything. It's kind of lovely that anyone from any part of the world and any walk of life and any situation, basically, can look up in the star and make a wish. And basically, it's making your intention have focus.
We found you performing on YouTube. Let's listen.
The music, of course, has to carry the words, which is why I'm such a great fan of Stephen Sondheim, because he writes both the music and the lyrics, and they're just so intertwined. They express exactly what he wants to say so thoroughly.
Not a day goes by, not a single day, but you're somewhere a part of my life, and it looks like you'll stay as the days go by.
You know, how did this all start? Because I did read that you were born Bernadette Lazzara, an Italian-American.
Yes.
Your father drove a bread delivery truck. By the way, was it Dugan?
Oh, no. Actually, okay. That's funny because my uncle drove a Dugan truck.
I love Dugan bread
trucks.
Weren't
they good? Dugan cakes? My uncle drove that. But my father had his own bread route.
But then I hear, you know, as a three-year-old, you were performing. When did it go from kids who perform, and that's lovely, to someone who feels the music so strongly?
Oh, I think it started strongly when I was a teenager, and you know how you have all these emotions that are inside you that need to come out and no way to express them. I had a wonderful singing coach that I'd go to once a week or twice a week and just sing all these great songs that I would love, that I just pick and love and sing. Sometimes it was songs of the day, sometimes it was, I might as well be spring, you know, What'll I Do and Mean to Me, things like that.
About the voice in general, it's never been more popular, I think we can say, with all of the programs, The Voice and American Idol and all the singing competitions. And yet, there's been a lot of criticism of the modern popular voice, that singers start at 1,000% and stay there.
Well, if you start at 1,000% and you have no place to go, then definitely there's no leeway for events to happen within the song that surprised you. I like to leave leeway for all of that. What does this lyric mean, and where do I begin with it? Where do I go with it? So that there's excitement within a song, because you start somewhere and then the song and what you're saying takes you to another place.
Mentioned you're going to be opening the Boston Pops season. Just if you could, a little bit of what's different for you. I mean, there's obvious differences when you're on the Broadway stage and you're also embodying a character, but what's different for you when you're on the concert stage?
Well, there's no fourth wall. You're not playing a character. You're playing, you're yourself. You can pick different songs that are the different characters that you've played. You can go through many different experiences.
You could drive a person crazy. You could drive a person mad. Do, 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 do. First you make a person hazy. So a person could be had. Do, 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 do.
And you can talk to the audience.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. We just came back from New York, taped some stories that we're going to have on Here and Now down the road. We spoke with Tracy Bennett, who plays Judy Garland in End of the Rainbow. She's both on stage in a Broadway stage, and then she turns around and she's playing Judy Garland and interacting with the audience. And she said, as a Broadway actor, that's the scariest thing she's ever done.
Yeah, that's something that's learned from... I've been doing concerts and nightclub, you know, 30 years, so that's something that you have to learn. And to break that fourth wall and to look at the audience, that's something you have to get comfortable with.
Yeah. We were asking her, as you're looking down the row and you're making eye contact, I can't imagine the feeling when you come to the sixth person, and I can't imagine this happens to you, but they have their arms crossed across their chest and you haven't got them yet.
Well, you can't think about that. You have to think they're just cold.
It's their problem.
Their arms are across their chest because they're cold. And then you forget about them, and then you go on, and you figure they'll come around later.
Tony Award-winning singer and actress Bernadette Peters, who will be opening the Boston Pop season tonight. Is there a song you'd like us to go out on? Another one of your favorites.
To go out on. Being alive is good.
Let's do it. Thanks so much, and have so much fun.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks so much.
Somebody hold me too close.